Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is Monday, September 23rd. We have three legendary traders investors today, Dennis Gartman, Angelo Gallo, and Ira Harris. Dennis is a well-known investor, economist, and longtime publisher of the Gartman Letter, has been actively involved in the capital markets since 1972. He worked in various positions at Cotton, NCNB National Bank in Charlotte, North Carolina, A.G. Becker & Company in Chicago, and Sovereign Bank. Beginning in the mid-1980s, he began publishing the Gartman Letter, which was published daily and continuously through the end of 2019. And from 2006 to 2008, he also served as an outside director of the Kansas City Board of Trade. Currently, in addition to serving on the Armada Hoffler Board, he is emeritus chairman of the University of Akron Foundation, and he also served on the NC State Endowment Committee. Angelo is the founder and chief investment officer of Lifelong Wealth Strategies, LLC. He has 30 years of investment experience. He serves individual clients and retirement plans, and he employs a global macro perspective to his investment strategy. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good morning, Richard. I'm humbled to be sandwiched in between two legends here.
And where are they?
Yeah. Well, hold on.
I don't see anybody.
Hold on. We need verification. Let me bring my wife up here. She'll take care of this right away.
I can't bring my wife and she start laughing too hard.
Yeah. Mine too. Who are they talking about?
Great. I thought we'd begin, Dennis, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
Well, the first thing I want to talk about is the fact that I think stocks are ridiculously overvalued, just almost comically so. I trade only for my own account other than as a soon-to-be emeritus chairman of the University of Akron's endowment. But the only trade that I have on at this point is predicated upon global economic circumstances that I think are becoming relatively unhinged, especially geopolitics. I'm short of stocks and have been for several months, and long of gold and have been for quite some period of time. And normally, I shouldn't say normally, but over the course of the past several years, stocks and gold have tended to follow one another. But since July of this year, the S&P is basically unchanged since middle July. Gold is up rather dramatically since the middle July, and I think that that trade is going to continue. I think that there's circumstances prevailing in the Middle East that at any moment can become tragic, to say the very least. And we could walk in one day and see the S&P down 50 points, 100 points in the course of just a few minutes, and gold being up $100 without too much difficulty. And given the fact that I've been long of gold and short of stocks, I actually added a small amount to that trade this morning as gold is trading a little bit higher and the stock market is essentially unchanged. I think that geopolitics are becoming very confused and I think deleterious to share prices over at this point. So I'd be very careful about being long of equities. I think they're extremely overextended and the public is egregiously involved. The fact that the public's participation is, I think, is high. I can't put any hard data on it, but to me, just listening to my friends, listening to the markets, watching TV, listening to the radio, I think the public is as involved in the stock market as they've ever been. And that is always, I think, confusing to me. The fact that we have such great participation in the overnight or one day options markets bothers me greatly. So I think stocks are incredibly overvalued at this point. And I think gold continues to be a bull market moving from the lower left to the upper right. So that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
Very interesting. And your thoughts, Angelo?
Fundamentally, I agree with everything that Dennis just said. However, we employ a rate of change overlay to GDP, inflation, and we measure it using fractal math and other means to gain some insight into what is growth doing, which it's been decelerating, and we expect it to continue to decelerate for at least another quarter or two. Inflation, we believe, has bottomed and is starting to mean revert upwards again. At the moment, it's mostly due to the base effects. And so, given what's going on with geopolitics, given what's going on with the debt and deficit and interest expense on the debt, you know, we believe that's one of the primary reasons why gold is doing what it's doing. We're long of gold and have been for quite some time. Silver, you know, is looking like it wants to start to participate. And more recently, just in the last couple of weeks, our signals are saying we can probably start to begin to dip our toe into the commodity space once again. And more specifically, into the food category, because the food items are really starting to take off again. And despite the fact that the Fed and everyone else thinks that they want to cut rates again in November, that's going to have a negative effect on, you know, the price of food and other goods and services in the next, you know, 2-3 quarters. So that's how we're positioned. Now, I do believe that for the most part, U.S. equities are overvalued. But given that we have a global perspective, we've been long India for over a year now. Other places such as Indonesia, Malaysia are investable, and their central banks have better balance sheets than we do. And most importantly, though, which is why they're investable, is because their rates of growth are accelerating, not decelerating.
Interesting. Good.
If I can jump in here for just a second, I want to add one thing. Angelo's talking about owning food. The first commodity that I've bought in a long period of time is soybeans. I bought beans 2 weeks ago, and they're breaking out to the upside this morning. So I added to my soybean position, just to clarify.
Yeah, sunflower oil, beef is starting to go again.
Yes.
Tea, coffee, sugar, palm oil, all of these things are starting to go. And over the next couple of months, I think the consumer is not going to be happy when they realize that whatever they were spending isn't going to be enough in the coming months.
And what about your thoughts, Ira, on the economy, financial markets, in particular, agricultural commodities? I think last podcast you mentioned fertilizer equities also.
Yeah, and we talked about beans. So I find it interesting that Dennis bought beans, because last week there was that article that I, in two different podcasts I did, one with you, Richard, where we talked about soybeans, because Argentina, Reuters ran an article about Argentina, or Bloomberg ran an article about Argentina actually buying U.S. soybeans because they were so cheap. And when the world's largest crusher of beans sells huge amounts of meal to those who need it around the world, when they announced that they were buying U.S. beans, I mean, I've seen the formation, and I'm sure Dennis has seen the same formation. So I've been long beans too. I sold a few out today. I wanted to up here, up at this 1040 area, because we're trading NOV. But I'm just watching it. So, but that puts me into Bungie and Archer Daniel. You know, I do love of the equity world. I like the commodities for several reasons. And And Dennis will certainly understand this because we've walked the same path for so many years. The fact that Argentina would say that beans, U.S. beans, are cheap is an amazing thing. But if they're cheap to Argentina, they're cheap to China, and China has to be concerned right now. You know, again, quoting Rosenzweig and Gernot Rosenzweig, who talked about the Gleisberg cycle, that drought is taking place in South America. So if I'm the Chinese, I'm certainly looking to where I'm going to secure my food supplies. Because there's one thing, whatever anybody talks about China, one thing China will never be short of again in their lives will be food. Starvation will not take place in China again. So there, and that always keeps my interest abreast. Now, we haven't heard a thing about China buying U.S. beans. Last I checked, I think they'd bought 130,000 metric tons, which was not a lot, but it's been quiet. And we know that the U.S. crop has been great. This has been a phenomenal growing season up north. Will it be south? Don't know. So it keeps me focused. And as with Dennis and Angela, and we've talked about it, I haven't built a big gold position. I've been trading gold from the long side, Dennis, because when real yields went over 2%, I thought gold would have a nice correction, because historically real yields that high are usually are a very great negative for gold. But that's what keeps me to the long side, because gold has not corrected here. And you and I have seen a lot in this world. Real yields, positive real yields, are usually very painful for gold, but not one iota. Not one iota. And it's just gold, because the silver-gold ratio at 85 is historically very weak. Now, does that mean that silver is going to rally? I don't know. You know, everybody's calling for that rally and looking for that rally, but I'm looking at the gold as a standalone. And I think due to some U.S. policies, they've really turned it in. They've enhanced its role in the monetary world.
Everybody asks me about silver all the time. They say, you like gold, why don't you like silver? And I say, I'm 74 years old and I can't take the volatility of silver. It it can move 2 and 3% in the course of a day. Gold rarely moves that much. It's far more liquid. So I tend to leave silver to the younger folks on the market. I like the gold market. It's liquid, it's deep, it's original. And I'll let other people trade silver. But I get questions all the time. How come I don't like silver? It's just the volatility scares the living tarnation out of me.
You know, Dennis, it's funny you say that, because over the weekend, I was doing my weekend work, and I came to the conclusion that I might just buy a small basket of a bunch of silver miners, 10 to 15 of them, small amounts, very small amounts, just for the fun of it, and to watch and see what that basket does, if anything. And, you know, if all 15 of them go down the toilet, you know, the amount of money that I'm putting at risk is almost nothing. It's more for the fun of it, for the sport of it, than necessarily for the investment aspect of it.
Silver certainly is sporty. I give it that.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of sporty, Nat Gas is back on the move again. I'm sure you've seen that. It's up, what, 6% today? I'm watching oil very carefully, even though it's down a bit today. Not really sure what's going on there in what I believe to be a moderately inflationary regime coming up in the next quarter or two. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens there. But, you know, the food items are what really stands out to me right now. That's
the problem with natural gas, as far as I'm concerned, is that the term structure continues to have a positive slope. And I learned long ago, you don't buy anything unless the term structure goes to an inversion. And it's hedgeable. So right now I think we're at a contango out to January and February of next year. If we start to see that narrowing of that contango, if we start to see it go to an inversion, I'll be interested in nat gas, because clearly nat gas at 2.5 cents, 3 cents is a far cry from nat gas at 13 and 14 cents per million British thermal units. But until the term structure changes its tune, until the term structure goes to an inversion, I will avoid it. I won't be short of it, but I won't be long. I'll avoid it. I'll leave it to wiser, smarter, and younger hands to trade natural gas.
So, can I jump in here for a minute, Richard?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So, Dennis, I would put this back to you saying that because I'm seeing that too, and the premium of NOV to OCC natural gas has been what, 10%.
Yeah.
So, I learned something. Well, and you're so good and have been historically really good with the miners. Yeah, I'm talking about the equities. So we're moving a little bit away. We're pricing commodities, but we're talking about equities. So number one, have you seen anything desirable? Because the gold miners especially have not performed very well to the metal, with the metal up here at all-time highs. We're nowhere near across a litany. But I always go back to the natural gas during the time that blew up Amaranth,
Yeah.
right? And I would watch that, and I knew that something in 2005, 2006, something was wrong, because the spot price of natural gas, or actually, as you talk about, the contango was so great because somebody was putting pressure on 6 months out, and the natural gas equities, EOG, we can go through a litany of them at that time, were not partaking at all. The prices were really lethargic. So I think what as we go into this natural gas, we'll want to look at what some of those natural gas plays are doing, because if that contango is so big and yet the stocks are holding and doing pretty well, then I think we'll be in a little different mindset. And there's a person who I talk to regularly from Wichita, Mike Lees, who's just brilliant on energy, and he teaches me so much. I'm 71, he's 84, so we're too old. We're like we're almost like Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner, but we do it in the energy world. So if you have anything to say on the equities especially in the gold and silver as well as the natural gas.
The only position I have on in gold is I'm long the miners. I'm not long the futures. I'm long the miners, and I'm long Nugget, NUGT, because I like it has a reasonable amount of volatility to it, and I do think that the gold miners are extremely undervalued relative to gold itself. It's something that will resolve itself over the course of the next several years. It's been trying to resolve itself over the course of the past several months. I think that's several years worth of activity to see the gold miners lead gold itself to the upside. Time, of course, shall tell. But the only trade I have on is long Nugget. I'm long also Newmont Mining, but I like Nugget. It's liquid enough to do 10 and 15,000 shares without moving the market, and that's my limit. So I'm comfortable with that. I think the gold miners are going to be will dramatically outperform gold over the course of the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Full disclosure, I'm long Newmont as well. I don't own Nugget. That's a 2x gold miner
Yes.
ETF, I believe.
Yes.
It
It gives you all the fun you need.
gives you all the fun you need. Let's see. It was 2008 or maybe 2009. And I did a test of UGL, which is the 2x gold ETF. So it's like 2x GLD. And Dennis, I did it as a test in my personal account to see how well it would track. And as long as you get the timing right in a bull market that trends well enough for a good period of time, those 2x ETFs do really, really well, and they track really, really well. So I suspect that Nugget would probably do the same here as well.
Nugget does exactly the same. The problem when you go sideways, the two times costs you a fair amount of money. So that's the one problem. You don't
Yes.
in bear markets and in quiet markets, you're going to end up losing money on Nugget. But
Yeah.
in a bull market that's moving from the lower left to the upper right, and for example, today, the 23rd of October, gold is up what 0.6%, and Nugget's up 2.3%. So it's working in my favor today.
Yep, exactly. Ira, just to go back to the nat gas names, Range Resources looks like it might just be starting to wake up. It's really, really early.
Yeah, I watch. That's one that I watch. It's up on my screen all the time. I had done very well with it and been out of it, but I'm watching. You know, I have a litany of things from when I sit and talk with Mike, and they really haven't done much. Interesting one that he had always told me about, and I'm not telling any great secrets here because nobody has a position that's sizable enough to make a difference. But stuff like Blackstone Minerals and things that are really out there but have pipeline capabilities and paying those types of revenues in a, and they've kept paying dividends in a really terrible market for natural gas. Although LNG, you know, the Biden administration tried to kill some of that, but the world's desire for LNG is just too great. And you watch LNG stock. I mean, that's just been a unbelievably great performer over the last 3 years. Just unbelievable, even with natural gas prices low because they're able to sell it on the global market. But you know, I love listening to Dennis has so much experience in the commodity markets. So I have to ask these questions as long as we have them here to keep pushing at that.
Definitely.
Any thoughts, Dennis, on that LNG market in general, internationally, not just limited to the US, like
That's actually beyond my ken, so I will I'll pass. I apologize, but I learned long ago, don't say stupid things about something you don't know anything about. I have the ability to say stupid things about things I know something about.
sure. Okay, yeah, okay. And Angelo had mentioned some of the emerging markets, and given your view on the US equities being overvalued, do you look at emerging markets? Anything in particular there?
Are you talking to me or talking to
Yes, yes, Dennis, yeah, go ahead.
the only thing I've done in the emerging markets was at the University of Akron. We had a large position in China, and a year and a half ago, I got us to move out of China completely and move to the ETF of emerging market stocks ex China, which has worked out relatively well. I think that Angelo was right. You want to be in Southeast Asia. You want to be in India. You want to be anywhere but China, as far as I'm concerned, and it's proven to be the proper course of action.
Yeah, no, I agree with that totally. I will say, for anyone that's willing to invest in China, again, my weekend work, the China large cap ETF has gone what I'm going to call bullish trade. So if there's anyone out there that has a fascination with China, China looks like it might be starting to turn a corner, but me personally, for my client portfolios or my global macro strategy, I have no interest.
The problem I have with China is the demographics are so egregiously bad. I mean, it's getting old, and its population is declining. It's the only country in the world that's in worse condition than China is South Korea. They're simply not having children, and they're growing older by the minute, and that's problematic. That keeps me from being, it'll probably keep me ever from being bullish of China. There shall come a time when it'll be proper to be bullish of China. People will make a lot of money in it, and I will be arguing that the demographics keep me on the sidelines.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
And what are your thoughts, Ira?
You know, I really had very few direct investments in China because I always try to play it on the margins. So when China was, and I still think that when you look at Australia, if you watch the Australian economy, you watch the Australian currency, you'll get a pretty good sense. Are things as bad as people say? Probably not. Where can China go here? I try to read as much Pettis. You know, we've done a podcast or two with Michael Pettis, and I think he's got such a good handle on it. I think until China really makes a move to be a more consumption-oriented economy with their middle class, I'll play on the margins. I want to see China really make some type of movement of that. And right now, they just don't appear to want to. But, I watched the Chinese currency, too, as a direction. You know, everybody's been bearish the currency, but even the FT caught on today that the Chinese don't have to depreciate the currency, or the currency won't depreciate as long as the yen holds itself up. And those two, I mean, I can look at that. That's one of my favorite crosses to look at. So it's holding in here. And I think the yen has a much greater impact on the yuan than the dollar or anything else. They're very aware. And that goes back, you know, to 1998 when, you know, again, I always cite that when Bill Clinton went to Beijing and the U.S. actually intervened to buy yen at the behest of the Chinese. So that keeps me pretty grounded here. I'm not doing anything in China. I'm trying to do around China. And you know what? People want to talk down the commodities because of China. I'm not in that camp because of commodities. And I think commodities are cheap. And Dennis, you know, raised a certain issue, which I hope we'll get back to, but commodities are cheap, and the Chinese are really good at stockpiling. They did that during COVID. The bottom fell out of commodity prices, the yuan went higher, and the Chinese did nothing but buy everything and stockpile. But I wanted to come back to something that Dennis said before, because I think maybe it was Luke Roman, or I'm not sure. Somebody has been running around with that chart from 1971 on the S&P Gold. Now, and that goes right to August of 71. It's an unbelievable picture that in terms that over the last, Dennis was starting in the business and I was still in school learning, but you go back 53 years and the S&P gold ratio is at the same price it was when Nixon took us off the gold standard. So I don't know if Dennis has a comment about that, but
that's fascinating. I have to go and take a look at that chart. That I did not know, but it's a fascinating piece of information. Thanks, Ira.
Yeah, I think it was Grohman who put it out there. I could be wrong, but it was, I'll give the attribute to him because he does enough work, and I'm pretty sure that's who put it out there. But I thought that was phenomenally interesting.
Yeah, that was an interesting chart. I did see the same chart. I learned about gold from the late Richard Russell. And one of the things I always remember him talking about, and now if you want to talk about time series, the chart that Ira's talking about is the gold S&P chart going back to 1971. Well, the time series that Richard Russell talked about was how 17 ounces of gold was able to purchase an average car, which back then was the Model T. And those very same 17 ounces of gold buys an average car today as well, even though an average car, if we want to use, just $2,500 for an ounce of gold, that's a $42,000 car. I think you can buy an average car these days for $42,000. You can
That's
definitely buy a
certainly.
Toyota or a Honda for that much.
That's a great piece of information.
It
I watch gold versus the Russell 2000 just because they had been relatively close in price. And several months ago, gold was 400 points underneath the Russell 2000. Now it's 400 points above, and I think it's going to go to 1,000 points or more above the Russell 2000 over time. So that ratio is something I keep an eye on just because the prices are so close together. It's an easy ratio to follow.
Yep.
Thing. You spoke on geopolitical risks earlier, Dennis. What are your thoughts, or how do you factor in geopolitical risks, risk assessment, risk management into your investing process currently?
I think that we are at a very difficult period of time. We're always at a difficult period of time, but I think we're at a very difficult period of time right now. The Chinese are clearly becoming, instead of just a shallow water navy, they're becoming a blue water navy, and they have now established a position in Djibouti at the mouth of the Gulf of Suez, which I find disconcerting to say the very least. And we are becoming less and less militarily competitive, and I find that disconcerting, even though I live in the within bombing range of the largest naval base in the world, right across the river in Newport News, where we manufacture our basically do our submarines and our aircraft carriers and most of our ships. I'm concerned that we're in the process of reducing the size of our navy rather substantively, and the Chinese are increasing the size of theirs. It'll be 50 years, but well, I shouldn't say 50 years. It'll be 10 or 15 years before they're actually competitive with us. But given the trajectory that we are profiling and the trajectory that they are following, that could happen quicker than anybody wants to anticipate. Do I think they're going to attack Taiwan? No, I don't. But I think they'll supply mischief in the region for a long period of time, and I think that's dismaying. Clearly, the Middle East is disconcerting to say the very least. And why? How we resolve the problems between Israel and Lebanon, between Israel and Iran, between Israel and the rest of the Middle East is beyond my ken, but it's only going to get worse, not better. And I think that that's on balance one of the reasons why I continue to be long of gold and short of stocks. I think we walk in one day and we have a war footing, and stocks open demonstrably lower and gold opens demonstrably higher. And in the interim, I think you still have both trends working in your favor. So, I think geopolitics are unbelievably disconcerting at this point, more so than in my lifetime, and it's only going to get worse after the election here in the United States.
Yes, good points. And your thoughts, Angelo, on the geopolitical risks?
I think China's long-term strategic decision to create mischief, as Dennis calls it, is brilliant because it forces the United States to spend more money that it does not have. And I think they're employing a similar strategy with Taiwan, death by a thousand cuts.
Yes.
So, same with the United States. They're not going to necessarily beat the United States, but you know what? Let's get the United States to continue to overspend. Let's continue to barter with Russia. Barter with as many countries in the global south as we possibly can, just to minimize their use of the dollar. And I am not one of these people that thinks that the dollar as a global reserve currency is going away anytime soon, because for another currency to usurp the dollar requires a lot of things, rule of law, deep and liquid markets. A whole bunch of different things, a fully convertible currency, an exchangeable currency. Now, will China wake up one day and actually do all of those things? Maybe. I have no idea. But certainly getting the United States to continue to spend on military is a great way to try and create, an imbalance in the global system. Dennis mentioned, the U.S. shipbuilding capability. I just saw some information over the weekend about the U.S. really blue water Navy. We're building hardly any ships. China's building more than we are, and other countries are actually taking up the slack on the building of blue water ships. So, U.S. fiscal spending to me is equally as important to the geopolitical aspect of things, because we're getting to the point where interest expense on the debt is broaching or currently exceeding
Military
military
expenditures.
spending. And that's a dangerous thing. Ira and I talk all the time about, what are some of the other financial existential threats? And a couple of them that clearly stand out is the amount of treasury bills in relation to duration that Janet Yellen is issuing. And do we get to a point where there's some sort of a disruption in the overnight funding markets to the point where the balance sheet capacity of primary dealers and banks they can't handle anymore without the Fed doing something to allow them to reduce the amount of reserves that they're required to maintain? So to me, the debt and deficit is probably a more immediate existential threat than the geopolitical.
As Herb Stein said once, that which cannot continue won't. The problem is, when will it stop? The deficit has been a problem for years, but I used to poo-poo it and say it was not problematic because interest rates were consistently going down. And for 40 years, people would laugh at me when I would say, I'm not worried about the deficit. For the first time in my life, I'm actually beginning to worry about the deficit.
Yep. Everyone assumed that when the Fed was to start cutting rates, which they did last week, everyone assumed that yields would go down. They did the opposite.
Yields are going up, yeah. At
Yields
the
are
long
going
end of the
up.
curve, well, that's you're going to see in the yield curve is going to become once again positively sloped. I've always said that positive slopes make banking idiot banking geniuses out of idiots, but inverted curves make idiots of us all. And we're going to end up seeing the yield curve move back to a positive slope just because the Fed will ease monetary policy, drive the overnight Fed funds rate to 2.5%. But inflationary concerns will drive the back end of the yield curve up. That's, I think, one of the real problems that we face.
Great. And your thoughts, Ira, on
Well,
that?
so I know Dennis and I have gone back and forth over the debt over since I voted for Ross Perot twice. So that's how far we go back. But this is a time, it's, and again, no, whatever happens November 6th happens. But as I say, come November 7th and 8th, now we're going to, as investors and traders, we have to look at the resolution of this. How do they resolve the debt? Or they don't resolve the debt. I mean, you don't have to, you can jump into the realm of modern monetary theory. But I know what Warren Mosler said. Warren Mosler, when he put that forth and brought it back from the dead, because modern monetary theory is not anything new. It was prevalent in academic circles 100 years ago, where people were talking about this. But Mosler, when he brought it forth, said that the resolution to it, of course, would be an enlightened electorate who would raise taxes on itself. I laughed then, now I belly laugh. But that's besides the point, because both Dennis and Angela bring up the point. And it's an issue that, I've talked about ad nauseum, and a very good friend of mine who is really exceedingly intelligent on international relations and foreign. We went to graduate school, but he is Kevin McCarthy. His name is Kevin McCarthy, not the Kevin McCarthy in Congress. But we've talked about for 2, 3 years already what would happen politically when the interest on the debt exceeds the defense budget. And we're there. We're
We're
there faster
there.
than any. People used to laugh at me when I would say that, but this is going to call into question going forward to 2025. Discretionary spending programs are all depends. If you don't start attacking some of the and start curbing spending, well, then gold has absolutely got great foresight here in seeing it, because it's not the inflation. There's no, that's not the issue. You know, is again, you know, gold is to me a bet on central bank credibility and the sustainability of the world's reserve currency debt. And it's, and as Dennis is right, we've muddled our way through and we've gotten through some periods. And actually, remember, it's not, it's only 25 years ago that the CBO was talking about we're going to run out of bonds because we were running such large surpluses. They were worried that all the bonds would disappear. Well, we know that that didn't take long, but we are in a situation now, and I can't agree more. And Dennis, I ran because I've been in this mindset for, but last week I ran the 200 month moving average on the 210 curve because I view that as more the institutional play.
Yes.
120 basis points is the 200 month moving average on the 210.
Positive slope.
Positive slope. So I look at that and I go, That's why people tell me, when people call me and people who manage some money for me, oh, I'm going to extend your duration. I said, no, you're not. Why would I extend my duration into this morass of unknown? You know, bond investors are typically very conservative investors. And the older I get, the more I fit that that mode with some of my money. But so if we go to 120, you know, there's a lot of room to run here. Again, if you think that the Fed's going to take overnight rates, whatever they mean in today's world, because they don't mean what we used to think they meant. Now that we're in the world of reserves and interest on excess reserves, and it's a far different world. But so if you go to 3.5%, where do you think the 10-year goes? That's what I ask people. Where do you think the 10-year will be?
7%.
Where?
7%.
I
Yep.
can't, but I'll tell you that it's funny that you say that. Because I went back and also looked at what happened in 2010, 11, when Bernanke was being Bernanke, and he went into the second QE, and the 210 went 293 basis points positive.
We can get there again without too much difficulty.
Okay, I can't agree with you more. I'm right with you, and I think Angelo is right there too.
Well, I'm gonna throw Dennis and Ira a curveball, because to me, bonds are tradable. The tens and thirties are tradable. In fact, I bought some mortgage backs this morning, at the lows.
What'd you buy the ones that Harley Bassman is pushing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And I
Because
say that with
they're
great respect. I think Harley
yeah, those
Bassman
are
is really a brilliant
because
guy.
all what he's putting in his ETF are all new issue
Right.
mortgage backs, not the old stuff.
Right.
So the bond market is tradable. Ira and I have talked about this. The same way, the curve, the yield curve has been tradable. You put it on, you take it off. You put it on, you take it off. But fundamentally, we've gone from in fairly short order, we've gone from negative 36. Here we are today at plus 17 basis points. That's a pretty big move.
It's
So
just the start.
I am long the steepener. I am long high grade corporates, and I'm long mortgage backs. But the bond side, those are trades. Nothing I do is buy and hold. Not in today's world. Those days are long gone. But at certain levels in the bonds, they're definitely doable in my opinion. But given everything I said about debts and and deficits, bonds are not a buy and hold in my opinion.
2 to 3 years or 2 to 5 years might be a buy and hold. Anything beyond 5 years is probably a sale for the long term.
Yes, for sure. I mean, I expect the long end to go to seven as well at some
Yeah.
point, because I don't believe that yield curve control is a solution. It simply transforms the problem into inflation. So the Fed can do whatever it is they think they need to do in order to try and hold yields down, but the problem is going to manifest itself in some other form. And I believe that it'll be in the form of inflation, because I also believe that inflation is a policy now. It's an actual policy amongst central banks.
I think the Fed has decided to that its dual mandate is no longer applicable, and it's now back to a single mandate, worried about unemployment rather than inflation.
Agree. And Ira's son, Toby, has been writing some great stuff on the politics of Japan. And over the weekend, I read one of Toby's latest pieces, and he was talking about the difference between what might happen if Takaichi, the woman, were to win or lead, and whether or not Koizumi might win. And the difference is pretty stark, because Toby outlined, if Takaichi were to win, apparently, I don't remember the details specifically, Ira, but I'm sure you do, that there seem to be some provisions in the law whereby she can actually force the Bank of Japan to reduce rates, or just a general easing of monetary policy, right? Which speaks to the BOJ's independence. And then on the flip side, he spoke about Koizumi, which Koizumi would have a tendency to leave the BOJ independence alone. Now, to me, the whole thing's a joke, because on the one hand, the BOJ doesn't have independence, and on the other hand, with Koizumi, he's sort of saying, well, we're going to just leave them alone. Well, if you peel away the layers of the onion, what are we really saying here? There is no central bank independence anymore. Not in the US, not in Japan, and elsewhere. That's the way I read Toby's piece over the weekend, Ira.
Well, and I, Dennis, I've been forwarding them to you. I don't know whether you've been, I may be using the wrong email, because he's just going out on his own, and he's really good. I mean, he's fluent in Japanese, he's literate in Japanese, so he's worked in the Diet, he has real experience. But and Dennis and I would probably agree with it. The BOJ's never been independent.
Never.
The Ministry of Finance has, depending upon who's sitting there, has used a heavy foot to kick them when they want to kick them and get things done, especially when it was more of a mercantilistic Japan.
Couldn't
But,
agree more.
right? Would you agree
Couldn't
with
agree
that?
more.
So right now, what Toby's point was that, and what the unwinding of the yield curve, Dennis, we haven't talked, but I'm sure it didn't surprise you. I think the yen went to levels because again, it's the great Hyman Minsky. When you get that complacency set in, it just takes on a momentum of its own and it pushes until things start to change. And I think part of that biggest change was once Kishida had told us that he's leaving, some of the more hawkish voices were raising the interest of the weak yen and its negative impact on the Japanese middle class, which is, we've always looked at the yen. Strong yen, short yen, as its impact on corporate Japan, the big corporates, the big trade. Even though, Japan, through when the yen was so strong during the greatest bout of deflation, because again, it's only the Japanese who've experienced deflation in the last, I'm going to say 100 years. I'm probably off in some regards, but they had real deflation, and the currency went, and people, The Japanese have so much money invested around the world that anytime that they feel like bringing money home to support their economy, it has a huge impact on the yen. And the complacency gets eroded, especially in this environment. But Angela, you bring that point up, and it's and I thank you because it's promoting my son, and I appreciate that. But he does really good work. But he just sent out a piece because Noda won the Constitutional Party, so the LDP is going to have a formidable opponent, is what he just put this out. So it's going to be a formidable opponent. Will she hold her ground? Don't know. But if it's one of the more hawkish ones, I certainly wouldn't be short the yen, because again, they're finding that the middle class Japan is not in favor of the weak yen. It's costing them a lot of money. And if commodity prices start to rise, as I think we all agree, and until those new nuclear reactors are all turned on, it's a difficult time period. And there is no wage gains. All whatever wage agreements take place, it gets eroded. So they need to hold this yen in there. How high can it go back up to, I think if she prevails, we'll probably see 150, 151, because she's been in that sense of, oh, as Toby's talked about, that they'll keep the yen fairly weak. And she wants a weak, she would like low interest rates and a robust fiscal stimulus. I think she's the Donald Trump of Japan. I hate to demean her in some ways, but I think that's where it puts it.
You don't think the carry trade has been totally unwound yet? I don't.
Oh no, I think we're in probably the second, maybe the, I don't even know if we're in the second inning.
Yeah, great. If we could do as a final question or a round table, your thoughts on the investment environment currently, just in general, as a summary, considering all the geopolitical risks and the political economy aspects that we just discussed. Your thoughts, Dennis?
I'm going to continue to be consistent. I'm going to continue to be long of gold and short of the U.S. equities market. It's been working. I'm going to continue to hold that trade. I think that short rates here in the United States, the Fed has signaled that they're going to take the overnight Fed funds rate down to 2.5 or 3% over the course of the next 2 years. That's going to be inflationary again, no question about it. So you don't want to be long the long end. You want to be short the long end. You want to be long the short end of the yield curve. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
Great. Interesting. And your thoughts, Angelo?
This is not your grandfather's financial markets anymore. Things are way more complicated. Things are way trickier. Yet the financial media tries to portray it as, anyone can perform financial surgery on themselves. Well, good luck with that, because things are very tricky. And one of the things that I believe is propping up US markets is something that we call passive flows. And those passive flows are coming from basically 401k plans. It's money that's just flowing into the S&P 500 and other large cap indexes. And those flows pay no attention to valuation. They pay no attention to whether or not certain stocks and their market caps are being pushed up for no good reason. And until something shakes that up, until something shakes that up, and/or the US economy and others begin to slow down even faster than anyone expects, because at the moment, I don't have any data or anything that suggests to me that a recession is imminent. I know others are, in fact, calling for a recession. I'm not seeing anything like that yet, but things can quickly get out of hand. And so if we start to see mass layoffs and a suspension of those passive flows into the large cap US equity indexes, this is likely to continue. And it'll be a stock picker's game, a global macro game, where if anyone's paying attention, you don't have to invest in the S&P 500. There's plenty of other places to go and generate a safer return, if you will, generate, more alpha with less risk. So that's why I say that this is not your grandfather's stock market or global macro market anymore, because of the geopolitics, the games that are being played, the central banks, the loss of independence. There's so much going on that at any moment, something can come out of left field and hit you upside the head like a 2x4.
Yeah, also great points. Thanks, Angelo. And your thoughts, Ira?
I'm just laughing because I find it so fascinating. No, you know, there's plenty of opportunities. You know that I like some of the foreign banks. We haven't even gotten into that with Dennis because who has a better worldview, especially when it comes to the global financials. But I'm watching Europe closely because I see what Draghi. And if we get another bite of the apple with Dennis, I want to go and talk to European financial system with him and what they're trying to do, and the need and the necessity of a capital markets union, because they did it all backwards. They needed a capital markets union and tax harmonization, and then the currency. But they've been chasing the currency, and hopefully they will get to it. But if that's the case, then European financials, if they're able to do it. If not, then I worry about the entire global financial system, because the huge amount of European debt that's quote unquote that exists on the German credit card, and the election in Brandenburg was had a better result than was over the weekend was anticipated. But there are serious issues, and I think but from those serious issues also become some highly investable concepts, and hopefully we'll get to that next. So I mean, I'm just looking around the world and looking for things like that. But again, one of my favorites, and they got talked about, is Tokio Mitsubishi Bank, which, if you believe that Japan can turn the corner here, and especially as they ramp up their defense spending, as Dennis brought about, you know, we're forcing the Germans and the Japanese to ramp up defense spending, but that means competitors for the US defense industries, which is going to change things too. But I always come back to, you know, you can't forget that Tokio Mitsubishi owns 23% of Morgan Stanley. Now there's a global footprint because they were getting, you know, when they bailed out Morgan Stanley, you know, in 08, that's what they achieved for their efforts, 23%. So it's one of those things. I'm really looking at things like that. So I listen to what Dennis says, and I listen to what Angela says, and I think we've covered some really, you know, highly possible investments going forward.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. And Dennis, is there a way for our viewers and listeners to learn more about your current work in some way, or is it podcasts or?
They can just send me an email, dennis@thegartmanletter.com.
Great. Thank you,
It's
Dennis.
been that, it's been I've had the same email address for 40 years now. It's not going to change.
Yeah.
I just sent you two things on Japan, Dennis, that are very readable, and I think you'll like the layout of them, but they're pretty good.
I'll read them as soon as we're done here. I'll print them out. I will print them. I'll burn a tree, but I'll print them and read it and take a magic marker and highlight the things that are interesting.
That's my existence, Dennis. We don't see, we don't change. Everybody laughs because I'll go through 1,000 pages of paper a week. I don't care.
I still read the Financial Times and turn it over page by page. I still read the Wall Street Journal and turn it over page by page.
Yeah.
I still watch the news move from page 32 to the front page over time. It's part of history.
You know, I'm down in Scottsdale. For 4 years, there's been no hard copy FT. I mean, for 40 years, I had it delivered to my front doorstep. It was delivered, and they didn't even call me to tell me that they had stopped. So now I have to read it online. I hate it. I have a neighbor, when he goes away, I take his Wall Street Journal so he doesn't have to cancel it. So I get the, and it's a pleasure to read a hard copy newspaper.
I get the FT 2 days late, but it's still worth the time.
Angela, how can our listeners and viewers learn more about your work?
I'm not out in the public sphere as Dennis and Ira have been and are. But I have a website, and from time to time, I'll post some of my writing there. But it's lifelongwealthstrategies.com.
And he's a handsome, he kind of looks like Bill Maher. You know, maybe I think Bill Maher should get him on to talk finance.
Exactly. Yeah.
Apparently, we have a short squeeze on black eyeglasses within the four of us. That's amusing.
Okay. And Ira, for your our listeners and viewers,
Richard, they find me here. Again, I've been doing some stuff with Tasty Trade, but mostly I'm at Financial Repression Authority, and I've loved doing these for the years that we have. And now we got Dennis, who we've been really missing from the mix, because between Mark Faber, which is always a joy. We've done some with him, and Dennis, you'd laugh because he sits there in his pajamas smoking cigarettes. I mean, I think I'm going back to I Love Lucy, but it's just to be with Dr. Faber, and Louis Gavet, and who else? We used to get Zuloff every once in a while, but these have been quite fun. This adds to the litany of them. I mean, this is really...
We've had Gary Schilling, you mentioned earlier. Yeah, also. Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dennis, Angelo, and Ira. Thank you.
Dennis. Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.